Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Excuse me, aren't you forgetting something?
I'm forgetting nothing.
Honest conversations with folk musicians.
Oh, did I not say that?
You said honest conversations, and like, I was thinking like, well, if it's just broadened up to honest conversations, like, let's get John Cena on here. No, we need to keep it down to folk musicians, because that's all we can handle.
I'm Cindy Howes. That's Lizzie No. We'd love for you to sign up for our mailing list. You can do that at basicfolk.com. Click on the red sign up for the mailing list button. You can also follow us on Instagram or Facebook at Basic Folk Pod. We're listener supported. You can make a contribution by going to our website. And if you click on the shop, we have Basic Folk beanies available in our shop. They are available as a contribution for $5 a month. They are handmade by this podcast's mother. Well, one of this podcast's mothers. We are a matriarchy here at Basic Folk.
Obviously.
BasicFolk.com. Speaking of the matriarchy, Lizzie, no. You told me you just saw the Barbie movie. Tell me what you thought.
I loved the Barbie movie. I laughed. And the music in it is so good. Like, give that music supervisor their flowers right now, because all of the license cues were so great. There was some really cute original music in it. But it was also just like so cool to see historic Barbies. Like, I loved playing with Barbies growing up. And the movie is all about how like a lot of girls today don't like Barbies for very valid reasons. And it's about how complex and beautiful and magical it is to be a woman, no matter what that means to you. So I think in the broadest possible sense, it's like a very inclusive and like just super fun movie that's also touching.
Listen, hot take. I thought it was going to be better.
Really? Oh, yeah.
I thought the Mattel stuff was pretty heavy-handed. Like, there was a lot of reminders.
I didn't love that part.
The storyline was a little thin and confusing. I thought there was too much Ken stuff.
Yes, that is one main critique. Actually, my partner, Cole, shout out to a man. Ugh, I guess shout out to a man. He was like, why did the Kens get so much time? And like the way that they wrestled with their gender identity was so much more playful and fun than the Barbies. Like, Cole felt that the Barbies ended up having to like be a bit too serious, I think, and like be sort of a mouthpiece for feminism in this like particular liberal way, while like the Kens got to be like so many different silly, vulnerable, different things. I don't know if I agree with that, but I think it's like, that's a good thing to be on the lookout for.
My favorite part of the movie was Alan.
My favorite part of the movie was Barbie.
Lizzie, tell me what's going on with you, particularly what you're doing on October 21st.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you asked. I have so much going on. Much of it I can't talk about just yet, but one thing I can talk about is that I am playing a show with my band on the campus of Stanford University, Leland Stanford Jr. University. I will be there at the concert hall, the Bing Concert Hall, in the Bing Studio, October 21st. It is very cool and prestigious, might I say?
Much like you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm cool and prestigious. LizzieNo.com/tour.
And to rewind, in September, the end of this month, Lizzie and I are going to be at the IBMAs in Raleigh. We will be there hanging out from September 28th to the 30th. And we're going to be on a podcast panel with our Bluegrass Situation pals. So if you see us down there, be sure to say hello. Please Don't be scary. We are little baby bunnies.
You may be a baby bunny, but I am Barbie. And this Barbie believes in herself and isn't scared, but also would just love if, as a courtesy, you didn't act really weird around her.
All right, we'll see you at the IBMAs. Don't know if you know this. We guest DJ once a month on SiriusXM's The Village. Our theme for August was Women's Equality Day, which was the day in 1920 that white women got the right to vote. And during our conversation, while we were guest DJing, we were talking about how, yes, let's celebrate women's equality, but also acknowledge the fact that not all women got the right to vote in 1920. And it remains to be seen whether all women and all people in America have easy access to voting today. So in talking about that, we made a donation to the Black Mama Bailout and also Abortion Care Tennessee. We'll link those organizations in our show notes. And if you want to check out our really awesome, cool guest DJ set, you can check it out on SiriusXM's app. Just search for Basic Folk.
Ugh, couldn't have said it better myself, Cindy. We are about freedom and bodily autonomy and everyone having a voice, especially women. We are feminists and we are friends.
I'd love to talk about our friend, Carl.
Carl. Dreamboat Carl. Is it time?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's time. Buffalo Nichols.
I've got great news for our listeners. The Milwaukee singer, songwriter, and legend Buffalo Nichols returns to Basic Folk this week to talk about his new album, The Fatalist, out tomorrow on Fat Possum Records. Our conversation picked up right where Nichols' debut album left off, traveling the world hot on the heels of the blues. Following a profound tradition can be just as frustrating as it is romantic. In his years on the road promoting his self-titled debut album, Carl, aka Buffalo Nichols, has witnessed how the blues can be not only a musical genre, but unfortunately a home base for some listeners' nostalgic, back in the good old days, artistically stagnant, patriarchal tendencies, and he wants none of it. The Fatalist is an offering to the gods of change, the gods of self-awareness, and the gods of integrity. He's really trying to tell a story about the blues that takes place in the here and now. One of the major achievements of this collection of eight songs is the seemingly effortless sonic collage that comes second nature to hip-hop but is less discussed in Roots and Americana. From a Charlie Patton sample to Ali Farka Touré-influenced finger-picking to tasty 808s to contemporary songwriting that wrestles with what it means to be a good man in 2023, The Fatalist tells a story about the present while keeping the past close and eschewing sentimentality. This sense of being in conversation with storytellers of the past is a pillar of what I would call the Black art tradition, all caps. And it's part of what makes Buffalo Nichols one of my favorite artists to follow right now. He's on a mission. He's creating really fun songs. And I think this album is going to surprise you.
The album is The Fatalist, and we will hear clips from the new record throughout the interview. This is going to be great.
We love Carl. This is a really good conversation. I think it's like
awesome,
kind of spicy. You're going to like it.
Great. All right. We'll get to our conversation with Buffalo Nichols on Basic Folk.
Buffalo Nichols. Carl, if I may call you Carl.
You may.
My friend, comrade, ally. Welcome back to Basic Folk. I'm so excited to have you back. And we're going to do it a little bit differently this time. Oh. I want to go track by track through your incredible new album out soon on Fat Possum Records, The Fatalist. But first, I want to like kind of bridge the gap between the last time you were on Basic Folk and now. Mm-hmm. What have the, like, so you released your self-titled on Fat Possum, kind of a great breakthrough blues album, talking about like where the blues are today. I think it was like a really great entry into that conversation. And then you like go all over the world touring this record. So what have your last couple of years of touring taught you about what audiences are looking for in the blues, and like how the genre is doing. Like if you had to do like a health check on the blues, what would you say based on your last couple of years of touring?
The biggest thing that I've learned probably is that it does more harm than good from a marketing standpoint, which is the only one that matters, apparently.
Everything is marketing.
Yeah, it's really weird because when you are labeled a blues artist, you get a certain built-in fan base, and the majority of that fan base has certain expectations because the blues hasn't changed that much. You know, generalizing here, but it really hasn't changed that much in a while. So people expect a certain thing.
Are there strategies or relationships or like parts of your imagination that you turn to keep yourself open-minded, like when you're up against all that, like that stagnant feeling?
Yeah, I try to just tell myself that I'm an artist and it doesn't matter what people think, which can get you in a weird headspace. You know, you can kind of get a complex or a chip on your shoulder, like, oh, nobody understands me.
Yeah.
But you really you have to tell yourself that in the situation that I'm in, because I'm not really, and this is a thing that a lot of people can relate to, but I never really feel like I'm reaching my intended audience. Mm. So I'm always kind of singing to people who, they like certain parts of what I'm doing, but at the end of the day, they don't really understand what I'm saying. So I can't rely on the audience to give me that validation that I'm looking for. So I gotta, you know, just do it myself.
Yeah, if I had to guess, I would say that that might be one of the things that gives you staying power. I think there are a lot of people that get by on like quick gratification and people loving and being able to easily digest what they do. Mm-hmm. And that makes it really hard to change. Maybe I'm just like putting a silver lining on something that's like genuinely not great. But part of me thinks that it's good because you're not like addicted to the approval.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, over the years of just performing, I've learned little tricks to kind of win over an audience. Mm-hmm. And I always feel kind of defeated afterwards because, you know, like I've been an opening act for a long time. And, you know, when you feel like you're not quite winning the crowd over, you know, you pull out your bag of tricks to try to like get their attention for 20 minutes. And then, you know, at the end of that, I just feel like kind of burnt out. Like I wasn't able to reach the people as myself. So I had to turn some weird act on to get it done. And it doesn't matter how much they like it. If I wasn't really being myself, it ends up being like very tiring.
Like a first date where you like have to carry the entire conversation.
Right.
Do you have a memory of like a show where you really felt like you showed up like as yourself and people were able to really receive it and you felt not like drained at the end, but just like, okay, that was my show?
It happens a lot. I can remember one show in particular where I played at Tipitina's.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, opening for Drive-By Truckers. And it was more so like the environment kind of worked. Because I was, you know, every once in a while I would get a gig where the environment fit what I was trying to do, because I was doing a lot of like, you know, restaurant gigs and and kind of lawn chair festivals.
We've done a handful of those together.
Yes, that's right. It's
the lawn chair crowd is not always that receptive to like, I'm going to innovate this traditional genre.
Yeah, no disrespect, because, you know, it's they're great people. They're some of the most open-minded people out there, you know, sometimes. But, you know, when you're doing certain things and you look out and everyone's just sitting there, you can kind of like start thinking too much. But it was just like great sound, because I use a lot of like low end and bass heavy drums in my show. Mm-hmm. And people are often kind of confused by that. But at this show, like the whole room was vibrating and the whole crowd was feeling it. And I was just able to go in that direction that I've been trying to go. And it was like, okay, everyone, like all these shows are feeling like maybe I'm not doing something right. And then that one where everything clicked and I was like, all right, maybe I'm onto something.
Yeah, it's actually hidden. And I could see that being such a great pairing with the Drive-By Truckers. That's dope. Mm-hmm. Are you ready to jump into your new album? I have a question about every song and I want people to like get a feel for it before they get to go out and buy it.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm going to be doing a lot of ums and well and because I haven't.
Good.
I haven't heard the album in a while. I mean, like most people, I make the album and then I never listen to it again. But I'll try to remember what's on it.
Okay. So The Fatalist, I have listened to it recently. Mm. I, for one, am familiar with it. Maybe I can reintroduce you to your album. Mm. Okay. Cold Black Stare. What really intrigued me about this song was the form that you wrote it in, which is kind of a guessing game. Like you're asking and answering different questions. Mm-hmm. And little by little, we learn more and more about the cold black stare mm-hmm. man, mm-hmm. like this character. So how would you describe this character if you were just describing like a human person to me, like in conversation? And why that format? Why the mystery? Why the sort of guessing game element?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the reason why I started going in that direction was because I wanted to just start slowly revealing the identity or the characteristics in a way that wasn't like immediately clear that there's a certain villain behind all of these issues. Mm-hmm. And the person that I'm trying to describe is, someone who not only goes out of their way to cause suffering, but also just enjoys seeing it happen. Mm. They're in the shadows and they're there at your personal darkest moments. Those moments where you feel like you're doing something wrong and you don't know what's going wrong. But little do you know that the person responsible for it is sitting right there, making sure that you're suffering. And I think towards the middle end of the song, I say, he's a devil, he's a liar, he's a billionaire. And that's essentially what I'm getting at is, the whole capitalist it problem that we have.
Yeah.
And I remember, when I was younger, there were some older ladies in my life who would, see me doing something wrong and they would say, oh, you the devil, that's the devil in you. And I'm like,
that's intense.
Yeah, it kind of messed me up being told I was the devil a lot. But
I'm no therapist, but I have to say it's like probably not healthy to be told you are the devil.
Yeah, probably not. But that's that's the way it is. Speaking of fatalism, mm-hmm. But yeah, I think a lot of those things that we attribute to something. Be some great evil force is actually just a man with a lot of money who's found a way to capitalize on human suffering.
Yeah, the Scooby-Doo of it all.
Yes.
There's a reason why your sanity is slipping away. What do you think it is? You thought that it was funny, you ain't laughing now. Taking all I have and now he's coming for you. He's taking all I have and now he's coming for you. Where you could have had a warehouse full of all the empty promises he made to you. He would rob the poor and the well-to-do. And if you had nothing, he would take that too. He's a devil, he's a liar, he's a billionaire. Taking everything and leaving nothing for you. Taking everything and leaving nothing for you.
So the single, You're Gonna Need Somebody on Your Bond, that is a reinterpretation of a Blind Willie Johnson tune. And there's a really cool Charlie Patton sample. So like, covers are something we know so much about in the folk space. Mm. Sampling is not something that's talked about as much in this like folk bluegrass roots world, but in the song, it works so beautifully. And it feels very present. And so sonically, like knowing that you are a really experienced producer, how did you make sure that something that like, not only is the song is like an old song, but that sample is like audio from the past. Mm-hmm. How did you make sure to like stay faithful to how it sounded in the past while making it sound contemporary?
I didn't have to think that much about the being faithful to the oldness of it, I guess, because it just, you know, it works as it is. Just, and I think that's just something that I've got comfortable with from experience. One of the big things that got me back into sampling, because when I was like in my teens, that was kind of one of my musical passions. Mm-hmm. That's where it started, was like hip hop and sample based music. And, you know, like the Mad Villain, MF Doom stuff, and yes, the whole Wu-Tang world, and a lot of Ghostface Killah has these, you know, samples from old movies and old records, mm-hmm, where you, when I hear an old sample from an old record, the first thing I hear is like, you know, 90s hip hop before I hear like,
yes,
you know, a 1950 string section. I'm like, oh, is that the sample from that, that Ghostface song? So that, to me, those two worlds of like modern production and old samples already just made sense. And yeah, everything else just kind of was already in me, because that song I've been playing for so long that it was really easy for me to just interpret it in a different way. When I was a gambler, nobody would go my bond. I fell on my knees and began to pray for Jesus to go my bond. You gonna need somebody on your bond. You gonna need somebody on your bond. When it's late in the midnight and death comes sneaking in your room, you're gonna need somebody on your bond.
Can we go a little bit like personal and broad?
Yes, that's the only way I know how to go.
Okay. So, Love Is All, such a cool song. There's a lyric that really stood out to me. You talk about the canon of good men, mm-hmm, and that, you know, that canon is kind of placed skeptically up for inspection. You're like, do I believe in that? What is that? Mm-hmm. So to you, Carl, mm-hmm, in the year 2023, what makes a good man?
That's, I don't know. I think there's like no such thing, actually. Mm. it's hard to say, but the 2023-ness of it is kind of what I was addressing, because I mean, we all know that historically men have been shitty, but I always find it funny when I'm on the internet and you see, like, especially in the podcast world, of like people trying to figure out gender roles, mm-hmm, in the most like perverted and messed up way possible. Like, so many people who don't know what they're talking about with such confidence.
Yes.
And
yeah, podcasts in a way, like, I know we're on a podcast right now, but I was actually just with some of my girlfriends and I was like, they need to take the mics away from some of these men.
Yeah.
They need to go. We need SWAT teams grabbing the mics. Because there's a lot of men that I feel like are like looking for something, a sense of power, a sense of belonging, you know, a sounding board. Yeah. And they're using this new medium to just like say their worst thoughts and like try to get approval for it.
Yes. And then you can get, you know, people of any gender agreeing with them. And then they're like, see, totally, this is, of course I'm right. Look how many people agree, right, with me. And some people get close and there's like, okay, mm-hmm, you have a few qualities that make for a healthy relationship, but then the rest, mm-hmm, are so off and people can kind of ignore those gaps. And,
oh, yeah,
and then the bar is kind of lowered. It's like, okay, they're not all the way there. But the thing that I was thinking about was, yeah, essentially how the bar has been lowered and you can do a couple of good things, and compared to other men, you are doing great because you don't, you know,
yeah,
you're not violent or you have a job. That's all it takes.
I don't know who the quote is by, but there was a great like feminist quote that said like all men benefit from the actions of violent men, mm-hmm, because, you know, if it's like, well, I'm not a rapist, I'm not an abuser, mm-hmm, at least I'm not that, it makes you like it makes women lower their expectations and people of all genders lower their expectations. It sounds like what you're saying is like being a good man is actually about holding yourself accountable to like be a whole person.
Yeah, I'm going to start saying that next
and not
time.
Just like do one or two good things.
Yeah, I've actually tried to like address this topic in songs before, and it always felt wrong because I don't think that I know, and I don't think any man really knows what it means to be a good man, because there's nobody that can really tell you, because we haven't seen it in a meaningful way yet. Like, everybody has people in their life that they like, but what does it really mean to have done good as a man or whatever? Because, like I said, it's always about comparison. Like, you know, people in my family will say, like, oh, this person is good to me because they don't treat me like this person who used to, you know, beat me or whatever. And you have this association, you're kind of comparing them to the worst example.
Exactly, yeah.
And we still do that. And I don't know how to look at manhood or whatever, this portion of the gender spectrum, and say, objectively, this is how you should behave. And there's a whole bunch of other things that go into it. But really, yeah, that's, I guess, now that I think about it, you know, manhood is kind of judged by how bad you aren't and not how good you are.
Okay, I need to sit with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. That's really deep. That's hard.
Yeah, it is. It doesn't make me feel good.
Do you remember which songs you were, like, are there songs that you've released as Buffalo Nichols that, like, were trying to address that same topic?
No, I don't think so. There are songs that I've released as Buffalo Nichols that, like, are more of the opposite, where I kind of just took on a, you know, borderline misogynistic character just to feel more authentic as a blues artist, which I'm, like, ashamed of, and I'm trying to correct that. But whenever I've gotten to this topic specifically, I always end up feeling like a fraud, or like it's not quite what I'm trying to say. So I always end up, you know, moving on.
Yeah, in that sense, the blues is like a really great place to start as far as deconstructing some of those misogynist tendencies, because there's so much in the blues that's like, you know, very black and white as far as gender. Yeah, I think it's cool to see you breaking that down.
Yeah, that's one of the things that people actually like about it the most, unfortunately, which goes back to your earlier question. You meet people who see no issue with it, and then you try to point it out, and then it's like, well, nobody comes to a show to get lectured to, but, you know, it's a mess.
We're out here trying.
So what does this mean? 'Cause I don't understand. It doesn't mean we'll never have to feel so heartbroken again. Who does it mean that I can wash my hands of this longing that's been burning since I don't remember when? 'Cause the rules, they have been written, but they're hard to understand. I've seen much bad behavior in the canon of good men. I believe that God is everything and everything is love. If love is all we have right now, well, I think we have enough.
Okay, Turn Another Stone.
Yes.
This is like a homecoming country song, which is a type of song that I love. What did living in Austin and traveling extensively as a touring musician teach you about, like, your home city of Milwaukee? And kind of as it relates to the blues, how is the work ethic different between, like, Milwaukee and more industry-focused towns like Austin or Nashville?
I've moved around a lot in my life, in my adult life, and I always end up going back just because, you know, life is hard. Not because I ever really felt like I missed home so much, but, you know, that's just, at least it's my personality is when, or it was, you know, when things got too hard and I couldn't see what the point was, I would just be like, I'm going home.
Yeah.
But my most recent move back home to Milwaukee wasn't really like that at all. It was more like, actually, I think this home that I was trying to escape for so long, maybe there was something to it. And as far as the work ethic, that was the thing that I've learned in my 30s now, is that people in the Midwest and these kind of industrial Midwest towns are very hardworking. But the reason is because life is just, there's just so many more obstacles, I guess. Mm. And there's fewer options. So if you want to make something work, it takes just way more deliberate effort in a Milwaukee than it does in, you know, in LA or New York, because it's just more, it's not a matter of opportunities, you know. Mm-hmm. We're all kind of facing the same difficulties, but if you work really hard in some cities, you can just keep going and going until,
oh yeah,
every place has a ceiling, but the ceiling in Milwaukee is a lot lower than it is in Austin, I think. And moving back taught me that it's not really a better or worse thing. Like, it's nice to be around people who have different ambitions, so to speak. Like, in Milwaukee, people aren't really after certain things because there's no access to it. And that's refreshing. But then it's also nice to be around people who have goals. You know, that's nice, too.
We all got dreams. Yeah. Now that I've returned to the place I once maligned, familiar faces bring me peace of mind. In this place I tried so hard to leave behind is the place from which I choose to say goodbye. Let's talk about the difference. Mm. I love this song. It's Thanks. Very moving, and it's like a very stripped down arrangement. Mm. And I'm asking for a friend. The friend is me. How did you learn to finger pick, and how did you develop the feel that you have when you're playing an acoustic guitar song like that? That's just like a sweet little acoustic ballad. Mm. Are there guitarists that you look to for inspiration on that type of like folksy singer-songwriter type song?
Probably. I don't know how I learned most things, because the majority of what I am capable of on guitar I learned when I was a teenager. Mm. So I can't really pinpoint a lot of it. But I do know when I play that song, I feel like I'm ripping off Eric Bibb. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the, like, a lot of my folk sensibilities came from Eric Bibb, who's really known, I think, as a blues artist, but he's just a wealth of information from all types of music. And then there was a period of my life where I was really into West African music, especially guitar players like Ali Farka Touré and Afel Bokum. And once I started learning the way that they play, which is like total independence of the thumb and the fingers, mm-hmm. I could kind of just do whatever I wanted. When it came time to write your story, I was barely mentioned. Just a minor role, a place you'd go when you needed attention. But if I'm just a rest stop for your soul, I'll let it be. 'Cause I just don't know the difference between love and company. And the sun don't always shine on me, but I know don't care if we live or die, but the light is ours to share, and it's only who's bleeding, but the pain is mine to bear. And I'm too weak to even speak or ask you to be fair.
As far as Long Journey Home, I am so excited for the world to hear this song.
Okay.
How did you create the perfect beat for the song? What sorts of percussion sounds did you look for? What did you try that didn't work? Talk about building that track.
That one was interesting because I had the idea. That was a song that I was working on before the first album. And all of this, like trying to mix the styles that I do, I've been thinking about and working on for a long time. I'm really into drum machines, you know, analog synthesizers and all this stuff. So usually when I'm using drum machines to make a beat, I basically track them one at a time. You know, you got your kick drum and your snare and hi-hat and all these things. But for this one, I didn't do it because I made this beat and I just kind of like recorded it to just keep the idea. And I was going to go back and like re-record it more meticulously. But then I accidentally deleted the file on my drum machine. So I had to go back and, I mean, I tried to recreate it. And I just, I don't know. I don't think it wasn't that I couldn't. It was just that I had given up. I was just like, I don't want to go do that all over again.
So all right, I just, this is it.
Yeah. So I just took that mono track that I had saved as a demo and I just put it in the song. Then towards the end of the song, I like added some computer drums, which I tried to avoid because I felt like it was cheating or something. But I'm just kind of a nerd in that way about drum machines. Yeah. But yeah, just added stuff to it. And I don't know if it worked, but it's on there, so it doesn't matter.
It's ominous as hell.
Thank you.
It's very good.
Well, that part, the ominousness of it comes from something that's come into my music lately, which is just a really kind of dark ambient element that is a lot more in my live set.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm still trying to like make a living off of music. So I'm not going fully experimental electronic music quite yet. So I try to like just sneak in pieces of it and not do a 15 minute drone song.
Yeah. Mm. But that time might come.
Oh, I'm sure it will.
And I'll see you there.
Yeah. Fill my lungs with water now. Sink me into silence. Raise your head above the clouds. Or bury it in violence. I took the long journey.
Ties perfectly into the next tune, The Fatalist Blues, the title track. There's a lyric that says, if silence set us free, I would never make another sound. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the feeling you had when you finished writing that song?
Yeah. When I wrote the song, it wasn't going to be the title track. But when I wrote the song, I was like, this, in a way, is like everything that I've been trying to do for the last 10 years. Not just as far as the production, but the message in the song and everything is like, this is like my flagship song. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then I went back and started looking at all the other songs that I had been writing for the album and it helped me kind of fit everything together.
Do you think that singing makes us free? Do you think that saying things can make us free? Like, where do you actually land on that? Like personally,
it just in my own life, you know, especially speaking as a musician and as an artist, I don't feel like speaking out has really gotten me anything tangible, which is not why I do it. But at the same time, you know, it's why I put that line in there. It's like saying nothing doesn't really get you anything either. It might get you in a room where people are more comfortable to have you around because, you know, you're a safer option. But, you know, if your position depends on your silence, then I feel like you've lost more. And, you know, being an artist who has nothing to lose is a much better feeling than feeling like you owe everybody. And as soon as you make a wrong move, everything can be taken from you. And even beyond artistry, as a person and as a Black person, I feel like until somebody can show me that shutting up is going to pay off, I'm going to just keep saying what I say. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I actually really appreciated a little mini correction redirection that that you shared recently on social media. There was a newspaper. I'm not going to get too specific because that's not what this is about. That said, like, Buffalo Nichols had a run-in with the law and said he would never return to X state. And you were like, you tweeted like a quote-unquote run-in with the law is an interesting way of framing racial profiling. And I really thought about that because I find it so tricky in this like social media age, especially like as Black artists in the roots space, I do feel like we're expected to like be the teachers and the prophets and just take all the shit and tell people what's right and like speak out and then take all the abuse. And that doesn't mean that it's not worth doing, but it does mean that it like comes with an emotional toll. So I just wanted to ask you about like how you're navigating that, because I struggle with a lot of the same stuff. Like when do you set the record straight and when do you just kind of like protect your own mental health? I don't know. It's not a real question, but I'm happy to be talking about it with you.
Oh no, I struggle with that constantly. And I really don't know what's the right way to do it. Or, I mean, it you got to do it the way that feels right to you as an individual at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I learned pretty quickly that I was kind of naive about the whole thing, but it became pretty clear that people like that type of content and not for any particular reason. Like, it's not like you are, you're not really teaching anybody anything. Like, people know that when you're Black, you get treated differently. So it's like, if you say
people are aware.
Right. Like, saying it can...
Invisible Man has been in bookstores for decades now.
Yeah, so... And this is... I tried really hard to... In fact, I made a point to, like, not mention race in my press release. Because it was a big part of the last one. And, you know, it's a thing that I ended up just having to talk to a bunch of white people about race. And
it's a nightmare.
Yeah. And
it's a nightmare.
Yeah. So I tried to avoid it. And it kind of comes up anyway. But, you know, it's come up lately just because of just the nature of the music that I make and the kind of person I am. And what I get is... You know, you get a little bit of people who are like, yeah, that's right. But then you get a whole wave of people who are like, how dare you say that you're Black and I'm white?
Like, breaking news. Race exists.
Yeah. The backlash that comes along with it. People kind of like to watch. They like to watch their favorite Black artists go toe-to-toe against a racist.
Absolutely.
But you gotta deal with it.
People love to say, like, so-and-so had the perfect takedown for these racists. And it's like, okay, but... Did that pay that person's bills? Did that help that person? Like, no, that person did a bunch of free labor and it didn't.
Yeah,
didn't do anything.
I don't lose sleep over it, you know. But it's like it's a waste of my time at the end of the day.
Yeah,
that's the naivety that I had. Is like, oh, if I just talk about it, people will change their behavior. Little did I know,
they sure won't.
They will not.
But I actually think that the way that you approach these kinds of topics is really strategic, because you're not like. I think a lot of people forget that we have more avenues for communication than just social media. Mm. Like, there are people who like are somewhat like adjacent to the music industry or in the music industry who are just like tweeting all day. Mm. It's like, okay, that's not like really getting us free. I think demonstrating through your life and your art what it looks like to be free. Mm. And then from time to time, verbally setting the record straight. I would say it's probably working, but
yeah, I think
time will tell.
I think I'm making some sort of progress because, yeah, I don't tweet really at all. And I use Instagram to say things. But the wildest shit I say is on stage where you know. It's
when people actually have showed up to listen to you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I find myself less and less in spaces where I'm in front of a hostile audience. Mm-hmm. When I was just getting started, it was like I was always in places where people didn't want me. So I would just like kind of go off on people, and they got to deal with it because I got the microphone. And though they can feel however they want, but it's not public, so nobody's like, there's no like audience kind of judging your clapbacks and everything. So it's like,
yeah,
you say something to them, and they're like, oh. And in real life, they got to sit with it. And I feel like that's more effective. And it's not about changing people's minds. It's about, I'm going to make you as uncomfortable as you would like me to be in this space.
And that's a lesson.
Yeah. Nowadays, people kind of just know what I'm about before I show up, so I don't gotta do that as much, which is much better. I love just making music.
That's huge. Yeah. You've done it. Well, yeah, it really works as a title track, and having that be the title track really kind of, for me, set the tone of, like, this album is going to be about, like, fate and destiny, and death, of course. If I had my way, I would tear this whole building down. If silence set us free, I would never make another sound. Not been rewarded for bowing to you. Could you imagine that I have got my own point of view? If I had my way, I would tear this whole building down. Talking about this moment,
yeah,
which is another song that deals again with, like, these similar balances between decisions and fate and power and death.
Mm-hmm.
What for you is the connection between the blues as an artistic practice and your practice of grounding yourself in the present moment? Put another way, do the blues have a particular relationship with time and the present moment?
Yeah. That's a good question. I think that's been my issue as a black blues artist born in the 90s, 90 something.
90 redacted.
Yes. Is that I discovered the music in a contemporary way, but I pretty quickly went to the early stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much a snapshot of their life in that time, especially artists like Charlie Patton, who has very, like, specific story songs of his life in, you know, Mississippi or Louisiana or whatever. And you go through the music and all the way up until, you know, you listen to Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, and you could just imagine that you're in the South Side of Chicago.
Exactly.
And then at some point it becomes this weird nostalgia thing, and you have all these people, like, doing these caricatures and playing dress up. And it's like, to me, that was a really important part of the music, was, like, you get an idea of where this person is really from and what they're really about. Then all of a sudden you have somebody just playing a character. And that kind of took me out of it. So when I started putting out blues music, I felt like that's what it's all about. Like, if somebody's going to listen to my music in 100 years, I want them to know what life was like for me in Texas and in Milwaukee in 2000, 2020s. And to me, you can't separate the two. If you are making any kind of music, but especially blues music, which at its core is a vocal and a storytelling music,
mm-hmm.
and you're not telling any story that hasn't been told before, or at least that's not unique to you, then you are really wasting everybody's time. The world was all but mine, and I almost felt alive. I left that world and I prepared for war. Mother, say goodbye to your sons. The road they face is a lonely one, and those who make it back alive will be men you don't recognize. So let this moment be on.
Do you have any thoughts about the sequencing of the album and the message you were trying to get across with the order of the songs and the way that they flow?
Yeah, the sequencing was, like, partially trying to, like, have a storyline, but also it had a lot to do with me trying to find the balance of, like, trying to reach a different audience, but also not trying to alienate anybody who discovered me through the first album.
Mm-hmm.
So the first song is almost like a tongue-in-cheek thing, because it's like a lo-fi kind of sound to try to get people to be like, oh, you want traditional blues. Here it is. Very like.
Here we go.
Yeah. And then like a little hidden message of anti-capitalism in there. And then the next song is the same thing where it starts out like sounding like an old record. And then it just, it's like, you know, don't get too comfortable. This is something different. Then I go back to classic Buffalo Nickels as a palate cleanser. It's like, sorry about that. here's what you bought the album for. And then it kind of goes along that path. And then I end with this moment because it wraps up the fatalist message in a more positive light, you know, to say that, you know, even if you do believe in fate and even if things are going to get worse, which they probably are, you know, just enjoy this moment because even if right now sucks, it's only going to get worse. So just be glad.
Carl! Oh, I'm so glad you're my friend. I need this balance in my life. Do you think you would ever make a hip hop record? And I'm not saying that because you're a black artist that I'm interviewing.
I'm racist.
But just because of, have you ever thought about rapping? No, because the production on this record is really interesting and I would be interested to see like what a hip hop set would look like from you. Like, what do you think it would look like?
Yeah.
Flight of fancy.
I've always felt a connection to producing hip hop music and I've tried it in different points of my life. But I think I spent more time working on songwriting, like from a, you know, traditional standpoint. Yeah. So that's just where I feel more comfortable. But I've thought about like DJing or things like that. Mm-hmm. I've even like, you know, sometimes I, when I have a captive audience, I'll just do things that are more electronic than anything and force people to listen to it. But yeah, that's one of those things that I'm working toward it. And maybe one day the time will be right. But I can't see myself doing it right now because I'm on a different path. And it's more rooted in the blues than it is hip hop. So like hip hop is part of it.
It's part of the same family tree for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm glad you said that because that's more my intention is to get people to associate the blues more with hip hop than with, you know, whatever the fuck
redacted.
It is now.
Redacted.
And I really am inspired by, you know, artists who have been able to do that. We've like jazz has always had this close relationship with hip hop.
Yes.
And then you've always had artists and now you have people like, you know, Thundercat and Kamasi Washington and Robert Glasper who are just like really bridging, reminding people that, you know, these are all part of the same thing. And I would love to see that in the blues where you could have a, you know, blues artists and hip hop artists collaborating in a way that's natural and not forced.
Let's go.
Yeah.
I will crowdfund it personally with my extensive wealth.
I'm trying to get an Ice Spice feature.
Yes. Let's manifest that. I'm trying to work with Cardi someday. The Fatalist is a really, really cool album. And I think it really shows off what you can do, not only as a guitarist, singer, songwriter, but also as a producer. I think people are going to love this record and they should buy it on vinyl. And that is a basic folk endorsement. Are you willing to do the lightning round?
Yes. Yes. I'm a slow thinker, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to try my best.
Yeah. Don't think too hard about it. Just whatever comes first to mind, say it.
Got it.
Okay. Jeans or sweatpants?
Sweatpants.
What superpower would you like to have?
Oh, I think I got asked that one last time. Laser vision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is one song you wish you wrote?
Oh, that would be, let's see, Ribbon in the Sky. Any Stevie Wonder song, I wish I wrote it.
That was my sister's first dance at her wedding a couple months ago. What is one thing you wish people knew about the blues?
That it's supposed to be good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What animal do you think you'll be in your next life?
Oh, if I'm lucky, a dog, a well-treated dog.
when you're driving, when you're on tour and you're driving late at night and you have to stay awake, what album or musical artist do you put on the sound system?
Oh, that's, I'm trying to think back to when that's happened. Usually it's DMX.
Yes.
Yes.
Because X gon' give it to you.
Yeah, I like feeling like somebody's yelling at me. And then he'll say like a homophobic slur and I'll turn it off.
It's so frustrating. I run to DMX and then I'm like, damn, he wouldn't really like me. Yeah. Often music is about loving someone or something that doesn't love you back. Yeah, that's fine.
That's a good way to look at it.
What was the last movie you saw and loved?
John Wick 4. Yeah, that was good.
And finally, if you were to run for president, what would your like short slogan be? Like what would go on your bumper sticker?
They're gonna kill me.
They're gonna kill me. Buffalo Nichols 2024. They're gonna kill me.
Yeah.
The Fatalist.
That's me.
Thank you so much for coming back to Basic Folk and walking us through your amazing new album.
Thank you for having me. I had a great, great time.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Sarah Wardrop, music composed by Alex Stanton. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for us on the SiriusXM app under Basic Folk. Check out our website, basicfolk.com. or wherever you get podcasts.
You can also share this episode with a friend, or you could share it with that one coworker that you have that you really want to get to know better, but it's like kind of awkward to like share anything about your personal life within the like sort of rigid structure of the office. But you're like, I really wish that you were more of like a genuine friend than just a work friend. Like, I want you to know who I am outside of this capitalist hell. So like, you could text them or Slack them or email them a link to this episode and be like, hey, like I listened to this like cool podcast about this up and coming artist. And like, I thought, you know, maybe we could talk about it after work, like over coffee. That's just like an idea that I had.
That's a great idea. All right. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.